This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's Jessica Crichton here. Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning and welcome to the programme. This morning we're talking about language. It took a year for women's rights campaigner Maria Beatrice Giovanardi to convince the Oxford Dictionary of English to change what she felt was their offensive definition of woman. She's now hoping to do the same in Italy and will be telling us why language matters. Also, a new report from the Institute of Fiscal Studies suggests that women in heterosexual couples are much more likely than men to give up their jobs after becoming parents, even if the woman is earning more than her male partner. Alison Andrew, Senior Research Economist at the IFS, will be joining us a bit later. But we'd like to hear from you as well, our listeners, on this. What's your experience? Are you a woman who decided to leave work after becoming a parent, even though you earned more than your male partner? Did you feel you had enough options open to you at the time? You can get in touch with us via Twitter, at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can text Woman's Hour on 84844. Text will be charged, at your standard message rate, or you can email us, as always, through our website. Also on the programme, the first UK clinical guideline for the use of vaginal pessaries to treat pelvic organ prolapse was published last week, which aims to help women make more empowered choices about their health. We'll be discussing the mistrust of health services by some women in the shadow of the vaginal mesh scandal. But first, a report into abuse in the sport of gymnastics revealed that nearly 400 people came forward to submit their experiences. 39 of those were deemed so serious that they were referred to the statutory authorities. The White Review, which is being led by Anne White QC, is looking into allegations of bullying, extreme weight management, use of excessive physical force and coercive control, amongst other forms of abuse. It comes after a group of current and former gymnasts known as Gymnasts for Change, who are taking legal action against the governing body British Gymnastics. Claire Hefford joins us on the programme this morning. She is a retired gymnast who helped set up the group. And also joining us is Sarah Moore, the lawyer representing the group. And now, of course, we will be discussing both physical and emotional abuse, which some listeners may find distressing. A very good morning to you, Claire and Sarah.
Good morning.
Welcome to the programme. And a pleasure to talk to you, Claire. And I appreciate you're taking the time to speak to us this morning about something very personal, a very personal experience. So I thank you for that. Now, looking at this report, this interim report, it deals with the time period between 2008 and 2020. And it revealed that 390 individual submissions were made detailing allegations of abuse. And that covers 90 different gymnastics clubs and includes 100 coaches from all corners of the UK as well, Wales, Scotland, England and Northern Ireland. What did you make of the report's findings?
I was generally very pleased with this interim report. The content was not surprising to many people who've been involved in gymnastics. And it seeks to reaffirm the need for our claim, which is looking to achieve personal redress for many of the athletes who've been harmed over the years. So it was unsurprising, but the scale that's been reported in terms of the figures, it's also been incredibly validating.
Do you have confidence in this report and the findings that come from it?
Now that we've had a chance to see what the interim report says, I don't think that it's possible that the final white review will renege on these initial findings. So, yes, I think that the report is going to do the right thing by the gymnasts and expose what they've found. However, the terms of reference of the white review, when it was initially set up, they were not enormous in scale. So for many of the gymnasts in our legal claim, our experiences go back more like 30, 40 years, whereas this report only looks at what's been happening since 2008.
Well, of course, you mentioned, you know, your personal experience and legal proceedings are ongoing. But can you tell us a bit about your experience when you were training as a gymnast when you were younger?
Yeah, so I began training in the early 90s. I was an elite gymnast from the age of 10 to 15. And I was trained by the first Russian coach who came to the UK. So I essentially grew up in a Russian training regime in the heart of Surrey. And it was a kind of unusual experience, which was quite hard to communicate to the people around me at school because nobody could see what was going on in my context. I trained 30 hours a week and physical and emotional abuse was very normal. And I decided to leave the sport when I was 15, having won a bronze medal in the junior British vault final due to kind of the bullying of other coaches and gymnasts in my context and feeling that the emotional abuse just wasn't worth it. I then went back into the sport as an adult after doing athletics for many years. And unfortunately, I was then ended up in a training context where I also then witnessed a really horrific attack on a 10-year-old girl and reported that to British Gymnastics and became a whistleblower. And that was when I was alerted to the fact that there were some major safeguarding issues within British Gymnastics.
So you left gymnastics at 15, and one of the things that this report found was that many of the individuals who submitted evidence and their experiences continued to be impacted by those experiences in gymnastics many years later. Is that what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, I went into athletics and I competed for 10 years, and I had nothing but amazingly positive experiences competing as an athlete. But when I retired from athletics and my body kind of finally had a chance to readjust to, you know, a kind of normal life that isn't massively about pushing your body to extreme places all the time, I then started to get what I would now call as PTSD symptoms. And at the time, I kind of took that as a sign that maybe there was something undealt with in gymnastics and that I needed to return to training. So I spent around 3 years as an adult gymnast re-engaging with the sport and training at a number of different gyms. And it was then that I sort of really was experiencing the difficulties. And it's only been since the Athlete A film came out that I've been able to categorize those very clearly as being post-traumatic stress from the abuse that I suffered as a teenager.
And the Athlete A film that you are referring to details the sexual abuse that was encountered by the US gymnasts over a number of years. Now, Claire, you've described gymnastics as being stuck in the 1950s. And I'm interested because you seem to say that athletics was a much more positive experience for you. But what were the major differences and why do you feel gymnastics is stuck in the past?
I mean, if we look at athletics, I think there's a lot more gender parity. So the issue with gymnastics is that you have women's artistic gymnastics and you have men's artistic gymnastics. And firstly, the groups, men and women, don't train together. Really what women's gymnastics is the judgment of women's bodies against criteria that are based around aesthetics. And there's a far greater emphasis on the aesthetics than the aptitude in many cases. Whereas within the men's side of the sport, it's really about displays of strength and power. So those are really reaffirming kind of those social differences that, you know, in this day and age just seems so out of date and belonging to a completely different time era.
So there's a lot of emphasis on what you look like and what your body is doing as a female gymnast.
Yes, very much. And that's why we've got so many women in our group claim reporting all kinds of policing of their body in terms of their weight and subsequent eating disorders that they've suffered from many years later because of those forms of judgment and training practices, which really require the gymnast to be in an arrested state of development. Even last week, I saw some comments on Mumsnet from a current mother talking about her child being at home during lockdown and her fear that this child was about to hit puberty and how do I stave off puberty and it's going to be so awful for her once she's gone through puberty. So this really speaks to the issues of gymnastics. It's called women's gymnastics, but the reality is it's little girls' gymnastics. And many of these issues around abuse in the sport will only have the opportunity to disappear once the sport does become a sport for adults and adult bodies.
Sarah, I'd just like to bring you in here because this interim report really did highlight just how widespread these allegations of abuse are. Do you have confidence in this case, both in what the reviewer said so far and what you're expecting from the full report later this year?
Absolutely. I think one of the most striking things from the interim report is the extent to which it's corroborative of the allegations that are being made across our group. And it's corroborative in a number of ways, both in terms of the nature of the abuses and in terms of their persistence and the scale. So we are not just talking about a few dodgy coaches or a few dodgy gyms, we're talking very much more about a systemic pattern of abuse that has been permitted to happen over decades, actually, in the case of the individuals whom we represent.
What surprised you most about this report?
I think when you look at the details of it and you see that 126 individual gymnasts have come forward and that 90 coaches have been identified, 100 different gymnastics facilities, then you begin to see that this isn't, as I say, an individual problem in terms of dodgy coaches and dodgy gymnastics, but much more pervasive. And it's in that context that we can begin to think about the culture of abuse, I think. And it's in that context that the questions really need to be asked of British gymnastics about what they have been doing to potentially sanction, condone and permit this to happen. And you've got to remember as well, I mean, as Claire says, this is about young girls. Often young girls, sometimes boys as well, as young as six. So we are talking about serious safeguarding issues and long-standing injuries which have flowed from the failures that we've seen across our group to better protect these athletes.
I do have a statement here from British Gymnastics, and they have said that in response to the White Review interim report, Alistair Marks, who took up the role as interim CEO of British Gymnastics in January, he says that British Gymnastics welcomes the White Review's interim report. We are fully committed to doing everything possible to help the review get the answers it needs to do what is right for the sport and gymnasts. I remain appalled by the claims I have heard and alarmed that some gymnasts do not feel that they can have their voice heard and have a future within the sport. I want to be clear to them that I will fight to ensure that no one raising concerns will ever see their gymnastic opportunities detrimentally impacted. There is no place for abuse in our sport, and we are determined and committed to change it for the better. So British Gymnastics clearly are identifying that there is an issue. And I know, Sarah, that the group that you're representing, Gymnasts for Change, were representing 17 different athletes, but have more people come forward since this became public?
Yes, absolutely, Jessica. So in the last week, we've seen very many more people stepping forward, both men and women, I should say, as well. And I think that's going to be a pattern that we continue to see. Part of what Claire and Gymnasts for Change have been incredibly able in doing is empowering other athletes to speak out. And it's by hearing those experiences, creating that movement of solidarity, really, that has enabled people to step forward and be counted and have their claims looked at by lawyers so that they can seek the redress that actually they demand here.
Claire, I wonder, because this report has shown how widespread the abuse is, you know, 100 coaches implicated so far. What would happen to the sport of gymnastics if there was a zero tolerance policy for this type of abuse? What would it mean to the sport?
I mean, that's a very good question, and it's got a complicated answer in that these practices are so normalised that, and particularly in the elite side of the sport, there are very, very few coaches who use positive coaching practices. In fact, you could probably name them on one hand. And so really what we need to push for now is an entire rethinking of the kind of structures that the coaching is based on. At the moment, what we have is a system that's very much focused on coach-centered coaching. And we need to move to a model that's about athlete-centered coaching. That's very normal in many, many other sports, but it's not normal in gymnastics. So the sport really needs to start dialoguing with other governing bodies in other sports who have up-to-date coaching methods, and those need to be brought into the sport. And the sport needs to be led forwards now with people who have the vision to create a safer sport that is going to be much better for athletes long term.
Yes. I do have a joint statement here as well from Sport England and UK Sport. They say Sport England and UK Sport have received the interim report from Anne White QC as part of her independent review into allegations of mistreatment within the sport of gymnastics. We'd like to thank the review team for their work to date, and we recognise the courage of the gymnasts, parents, coaches and others from across the gymnastics community who have come forward to share their experiences with the review. For you, Sarah, what would you like to see happen as a result of this report?
I think as a result of this report, in legal terms, we'd like to see British Gymnastics doing what Alistair Marks indicates in this statement and really engaging with the individuals involved here. The White Review, we now have more confidence, will do an excellent job in delineating the problem. But what we need here is individual redress and for the gymnasts themselves to be involved in the conversation about reform. So we'd invite British Gymnastics to engage with us and those whom we represent directly at this point.
Sarah and Claire, it's been a pleasure to talk to you this morning. Claire, again, thank you so much for sharing your personal experiences. Thank you.
You're welcome.
OK, time now to talk about language. And if you've ever looked up the word woman in the dictionary recently, you might have noticed that the definition has changed. That's thanks to a campaign by women's rights activist Maria Beatrice Giovanardi. Now, Maria has also had the terms associated with woman changed in the thesaurus too. And now she's trying to do the same thing in Italy. Maria joins us this morning. Very good morning to you, Maria.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you on the programme. So please, for those of our listeners that don't know, what was wrong with the previous definition of woman in the dictionary, and why did you want to change it?
So basically I found this definition via Google because Oxford licensed its content to all the search engines. And what was wrong was that basically there were a lot of synonyms such as, you know, piece, bit, baggage, bitch, and a lot of other derogatory words. But also within the definition, there were example sentences such as, I told you to be home when I get home, little woman, or, you know, if this doesn't work, they'll become women of the streets. Like typical sort of like negative stereotypes. And also most of the example sentences were patronizing women and they were showing them as sexual objects or objects of men. So this was what was wrong with it, and then why also we started the campaign to change it. Yeah,
it doesn't sound great when you list it out like that. More than 34,000 people signed your petition. The definition has now changed. So what is it now?
Well, they sort of like revolutionized it in a way that before the woman had a passive role in the definition, and now, you know, the example sentences changed to, you know, a woman that puts kids through college, and you know, women of letters, women of science, the woman of the moment. So they basically made the effort to change the way women are represented in the definition and are represented. And also they changed the fact that before, you know, a woman was a man's lover or a man's partner, and now it's just a person's partner. And this was a huge victory for, of course, the LGBTQ community. And then, yeah, they removed lots of the derogatory synonyms. And yeah, I mean, I'm quite happy. It's not 100% perfect, but it's definitely much better. So
you've also said, though, that the definitions for man were also a lot more exhaustive than those for woman. So can you give us a few examples of what was in the dictionary for man?
Yes, they were, well, the men were actually playing an active role in the definition. So, you know, the example sentences where he was a solid Labour voter, or, you know, a Cambridge man, or, you know, a man that plays basketball. Like, men were just like being human beings and like doing things, and they're also excelling at them. And women were were discriminated against. So, yeah, and there are no derogatory synonyms whatsoever on the word man. So that was another problem. They haven't added any, which that was not our goal, of course. We don't want to discriminate anybody. But yeah.
Now, when you challenged the Oxford Dictionary of English, what were the justifications given for having those definitions and synonyms of woman?
Yeah, so the first challenge, which is also the one I'm getting in Italy, was that, you know, a dictionary had the role of the dictionary is to describe the way society is and how people speak, not to prescribe a reality or proscribe a reality. So that was the first, the main real challenge, really. But we kept saying that, first of all, like, not everyone speaks like this, but also that sexism, just as, you know, homophobia, racism, xenophobia, are serious issues, and it's not a joke, or it's not trivial to basically speak about sexism, because a lot of people were saying, you know, you're not going to change the world by changing a definition, and we understand that, but this was just one of the examples of everyday sexism and how it's not taken seriously, and how sexism actually has a huge impact on women, because we are discriminated against ever since we're born. And you know, even I love two quotes. One is from Angelo Carter that says, language is power, life, and the instrument of culture, but it's also the instrument of domination and liberation. And another one from Toni Morrison that says, you know, oppressive language does more than represent violence, it is violence. And I think, you know, language has been used throughout history to oppress different groups, you know, whether it's, you know, from a religious perspective, or, you know, in under the racist spectrum, or homophobic purposes. So, and I think sexism is still, of course, something that it's not taken seriously, unfortunately, especially in language, because, you know, we have, you know, even in the media or in TV, we always see people discriminate, well, men discriminating against women, and no one really caring, or yeah, so. It's sort of like a symbolic campaign, I guess.
Of course, but as you rightly pointed out, language does matter. Now, you're trying to do the same thing in Italy. You've come across Trecani, the online Italian dictionary, and you're trying to get the same definition of woman changed. What's the response been, and is it going well?
Yeah, so we just started after Oxford decided to change. Asked Trecani, which is a huge institution in Italy, of course, like a public interest as well. And in November, they said they weren't going to change it. So this March, for the 8th of March, for International Women's Day, we wrote an open letter co-signed by over 100 people, very influential people in the civil society, from, you know, the vice president of the Bank of Italy to lots of politicians and etc., asking again to remove the sexist definition, the sexist sort of like connotations within the definition, And the response has been that the director said they sort of like associated us to, you know, the movements in the 70s that were like of women burning books and patronizing us. And
so not positive then, but you have had some high profile support from the president, no less, Sergio Mattarella. So could that change their mind?
Yeah, so again, the Mattarella did a wonderful speech. I think Oxford answered in the same way in the beginning, and of course they are a huge institution, so we weren't expecting a yes, please, like thank you. We'll keep challenging them. We'll probably start a petition, and Mattarella also, yes, I'm sure he had an impact. He's had an impact, and I'm sure they'll change it. We'll just keep fighting. We'll just need to keep fighting.
Well, best of luck for the rest of their campaign, and thank you for what you've done. It's incredible work. Thank you, Maria. That's Maria Beatrice Giovanardi there, women's rights activist. And now, do you have a budding writer in your house? If you have a teen between 14 to 18 who likes to write fiction, maybe has found it an outlet during lockdown, the BBC Young Writers Award is open for another 2 weeks, closing at 9 a.m. sharp on Monday, the 22nd of March. All you need is a short story about any topic and in any style of up to 1,000 words, which will be read by some stellar judges. The singer-songwriter Arlo Parks and the writers Louise O'Neill, Robert Webb and Alex Wheatle, all chaired by Katie Thistleton of Radio 1. The best 5 stories are read by actors and published in an anthology. The winner is offered mentoring and all 5 writers will get a great day out with the BBC. All the details are on the BBC website. Just go to bbc.co.uk/YWA. Now, a new report from the Institute of Fiscal Studies suggests that women in heterosexual couples are much more likely than men to give up their jobs or cut their hours after becoming parents, even if the woman earns more than her male partner. Alison Andrew is the senior research economist at the IFS and joins us this morning. Very good morning to you, Alison.
You too.
We'll come on to what these findings tell us, I suppose, about the inequalities that exist between the genders when it comes to pay. But first, just give us some background on how these results were collated. I believe is it part of a wider review that the IFS are currently doing?
Exactly. So this is a small part of the gender chapter for the IFS's Deaton Review on Inequalities, which is a long-run project looking at various aspects of inequalities in the UK. So like over health, education, and then over gender, race, and then we're looking at labour markets, etc.
And what did the results show then about the way men and women's jobs and their hours changed after they became parents?
Yeah, so the gender gaps in paid work tend to open up a lot after individuals become parents. And what we show in this research is that this is the case even when women previously had a higher wage than their partner. And so these are the group of households who you might think that all of the financial incentives point towards them prioritising the woman's work. But actually, if we look in these households, these higher earning women drop their hours of work by an average of a quarter, and a further 13% drop out of the labour force entirely. So it really tells us that this doesn't seem to be what's going on. It doesn't seem to be largely driven by households prioritising the paid work of the person with the highest earning capability. Rather, it always seems to be, on average, women who take the largest step back, whilst men's careers seem remarkably unaffected by parenthood.
OK, so it counteracts that common myth then. Were you surprised then by these results that, you know, the woman, even as the highest earner, was more likely to stop work?
I think just how similar households where the woman was the highest earner look to households where she wasn't is quite surprising. Also, the persistence of these effects. So these aren't short-term effects. Women's participation in paid work and hours drop immediately, and then they stay at that much lower level for at least the next 10 years. And that's where our data runs out, but we think it lasts much longer.
Okay, so do you think this tells us anything about, I suppose, the social norms in place at the moment and why women often end up carrying more of the childcare duties.
Exactly. So I think it's really important to think that couples are making these choices within loads of social norms. So whether that's social pressures from friends and family about whether women should take a larger caregiving role, or whether men should be a primary breadwinner, or just sort of small things like schools often using the mother as a default caregiver, that all serve to reinforce sort of very traditional gendered norms.
How much of, I suppose, the women that responded to you felt they had a choice? Because it's, you know, it's easy to say that even though women were earning more, they felt obliged to become the primary caregiver, but perhaps they wanted to. Perhaps it was that woman's choice to decide to give up work and stay at home and be the stay-at-home parent.
Absolutely. And I think that's a crucial thing to say, is that the care work that people do, whether that's paid or unpaid, is obviously crucial for our society and our economy. And that's not what's at issue here. We want to get to a stage where individuals can make meaningful choices. And at the moment, where we have quite an unequal policy environment in terms of it's quite difficult often for fathers to take a good amount of paternity leave at high pay. And when couples are making these decisions within a lot of social norms, we really don't know the extent to which all of this stepping back from paid work reflects genuine choices. And it does seem likely that for some women, they would prefer to take a larger role in paid work. And likewise, for some men, they may prefer to take a larger role in the care of their children.
We had quite a few people contact us about this on social media. I'm reading one out here from Twitter from a woman that said she stepped back from a teaching job for 10 years while her three children were small. Husband was away with the RAF lots. So thankful that she had the chance to do this, as the job was well paid. Back in a full-time post now, so no real impact in the career. Pension not looking too good, though. I wonder, with the results that you've found, what does it tell us about you've hinted at it previously, but the systematic problems between the genders in the labour market?
Yeah, so I think the choices that men and women make around childbirth can have quite long lasting impacts, both because they establish norms and habits within the household, but also if women take a large amount of time off, it often is hard for them to get back into a job with a comparable pay. And they lose out on a lot of pay and promotion decisions along the way. And so what's interesting, what we find is that hours and employment rates drop off immediately. And then we have this slow accumulation of the opening of the wage gap, where slowly it seems that women earn less per hour. And large part of that might be because they've either switched to jobs that might be a bit more flexible, or they've reduced their hours.
We've also had another tweet come in from Alison that says, 4 children later and 15 years later, I retrained and had to start again. It certainly was the right decision for me. It does set you back a lot, she said in capital letters, in potential earnings and career progression, though. So, Alison, what would you like to see in terms of policy changes that can make it better?
Well, I think that actually highlights a really positive one, that there's you know, there are a lot of women in the UK who have perhaps stepped back entirely from paid work or reduced their hours a lot when their kids were young. And now they find themselves in a situation where they don't need to do as many hours of childcare. And there could be real scope for policy to help more women move back into paid work if that is their choice. And then likewise, we've got policies around parental leave. So many Scandinavian countries have what's called use it or lose it months, where leave is reserved for the father and can't be transferred. And this has been quite effective at encouraging fathers to take more time with their kids during the early years. I think the final thing I'd say here is that the status quo is really costly. We've got a lot of women dropping out. And this, therefore, policies that are able to help women to move back into the labour force are going to generate tax revenue. And they're going to mean that those policies may not be as costly as you would first think.
Alison, thank you for shedding light on the issue.
Thank you.
Alison Andrew there, the senior research economist at the Institute of Fiscal Studies. Now, it's hoped that new guidelines released last week will help to empower women when it comes to dealing with pelvic organ prolapse. The first UK clinical guideline for the use of vaginal pessaries aims to help women learn and understand if a pessary is the right option for them. Joining us now is Kate Lowe, who is the chair of the UK Clinical Guideline Group for Pessary Use for Prolapse, and also Kath Sansom, women's health campaigner and founder of Sling the Mesh. A very good morning to you both.
Hello.
Kate, let's start with you. Please just shed some light. What is a vaginal pessary for those that don't know, and how does it treat prolapse?
A vaginal pessary is a collective term for a number of vaginal devices that are inserted into the vagina to support walls that are falling due to prolapse. It's usually plastic or rubber device, and they come in different shapes and sizes. The most common one is a basic ring-shaped pessary, and they've been in use for hundreds and hundreds of years. And although the design is evolving, it is still very much a basic supportive device that sits within the vaginal walls to reduce the symptoms of prolapse. And it's considered one of the non-surgical management options for prolapse.
So how do you feel this treatment differs from what's already out there for vaginal prolapse?
It's completely different. If you have a prolapse, you have a number of options. You can wait and see how things go. You can employ some lifestyle modification measures, changing your diet, looking at constipation, pelvic floor exercises, which obviously has now evidence behind it for effectiveness. And then you can have something supporting. So at the end of the day, the prolapse obviously is the walls, the compartments of the vagina sort of falling down and possibly beyond the entrance to the vagina and creating bothersome symptoms. And to reduce those bothersome symptoms, you need to restore that vaginal anatomy. And you can do it with a pessary device very effectively for a very large number of women. And then obviously for some women, you might also restore that vaginal anatomy with surgery.
Okay, so the guideline that has been released is evidence-based. What does it say, and how do you feel it will further help women?
It's really, it's drawing together that pessaries are in very common use, but very little is said about them or really known about them. It's a sort of unglamorous side, really, of prolapse, but they really are very effective, very well tolerated, provide a lot of satisfaction in treatment. And this guideline really is the first guideline that will bring together the multidisciplinary element of pessary provision, because it's provided by doctors, nurses, physiotherapists. So it's bringing together all those clinicians and women to really raise the kind of voice, really, for saying this is a really decent option that we would like to hear about earlier in our prolapse journey, possibly. And certainly understand more when we actually do seek help for prolapse, to understand more about how they work, how long you can use them for. And for that, you need a really broad framework of training and practitioner skill so that women are getting access to the same level of care wherever they present.
Kath, I'd like to bring you in here. You have obviously a lot of experience in women's health matters. And now the guideline was written with the background of the Baroness Cumberledge report, which focused on three recent scandals in women's health, one of which was the pelvic mesh, which I know is your area of expertise. So how do you feel that report influenced the new guideline on pessaries?
I'm hoping it played a huge part. I mean, the biggest thing to come out of the Baroness Cumberledge review was women being routinely ignored or dismissed when raising concerns about their healthcare, women not being given full information about all the options and treatments available. It was about women being rushed into a surgical procedure using mesh when actually physiotherapy or these pessaries actually could have helped. They should have at least been offered. So I like to think it's played a huge part. And I would just like to say to Kate, we really welcome these guidelines because it gives not only women confidence in trying this holistic approach, but also clinicians, because what we've seen in the campaign and in the Cumberledge Review, too many women were rushed for surgery when they really didn't need to be. They should have been offered a natural approach first.
And because of that, Kath, and because of other scandals involving women's health, is it fair to say that there's a sense of distrust among women when they're given these new options for their health?
There is a huge sense of mistrust, certainly within the MeSH campaign, but I think I speak for a lot of other women's healthcare. That trust needs to be rebuilt. I think so many women have been to their doctors and, you know, it's perhaps taken 3, 4, 5, up to 10 times to be listened properly and get a diagnosis. Certainly in the MeSH campaign, women have gone back to the GPs or their implanting surgeon and they've been belittled, denied. They've been told that they have psychiatric problems or they're not dealing with their pain very well. I mean, you imagine these women, it takes a lot of confidence to keep having to go back to a clinician that is ignoring them. And actually, Baroness Cumberledge herself yesterday at the all-party parliamentary group, she said, and it says it so well, she said, women have been treated in a cavalier fashion by a healthcare system that appears to have lost its way. And it really feels like that in gynaecology, urogynaecology and urology. And certainly in the Facebook support group, Sing the Mesh, I mean, there's almost 9,000 people. And I would say the majority of us in there, we have lost trust in the medical professionals. And that's tragic. It shouldn't be like that.
Well, Kate, listening to what Kath has said there, do you feel cultural change is needed?
I think cultural change is happening. Actually, I think clearly the throughput from the MeSH report, the ongoing parliamentary group looking at the way these things are managed, the way women listen to, is very important. I think probably in the guideline situation, what we're really after is that this is actually a treatment that is already in very widespread use. So what we're really trying to say is make women more aware of it, make the provision more consistent, and give women longer term options really for managing their prolapse symptoms so that they don't rush to surgery, absolutely not, because often it's not actually what they need at that point in time. So this is about actually helping women to understand that taking the long view over your prolapse symptoms might actually in the end be you managing yourself in a much better way and feeling much happier with what's going on. And I think it's also women are, you know, that they have a problem, they sit on it for a long time and then they come forward and they sort of want the problem over. They're fed up to-ing and fro-ing to the doctors. But understanding that perhaps taking the long view, using pessaries for a certain amount of time can buy them time, can leave them still active and still able to do things is very important. And that requires a dialogue with their clinician. And it's about, this guideline really is about kind of matching the dialogue so that the clinicians have a better way to speak to the women and the women have a more empowered way to speak to the clinicians to say, is this right for me? Is this what I want to be doing now? What do you think? And continuing that conversation as they go through their life, really.
Well, Kate Lowe and Kath Ansom, thank you so much for joining Women's Hour this morning. A pleasure to talk to you. A pleasure to have your company on the Women's Hour podcast. Join us again soon.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. Series 3 of Radio 4's top comedy history podcast, You're Dead to Me, is now in full swing.
That's when you find yourself in the pocket of Big Asclepius.
We like to learn and laugh about the past by pairing up a top historian with a top comedian.
That is hangry at a new level, isn't it?
So far in this series, we've met the Irish pirate queen, Grainne O'Malley, explored the strange world of ancient Greek and Roman medicine, and discovered the dramatic family life of the Borgias.
All I know about the Borgias is from Assassin's Creed 2.
So make sure you've subscribed to You're Dead to Me on BBC Sounds.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.